So, let's look at the other four phenomena, and then the four phenomena is one is the. The snake, it's not that it's not heard. We'll come back to the idea, but the snake, the sloughing off of its skin is the recalling the original curse. It's reliving that original curse of the snake. Well, you're putting the cart before the horse. We're going to get to that, okay? The idea of voice, yes. How do those voices come together? And I think it'll come clear, okay? Hold on to it. Okay. So let's look at the consequences for a woman. For example, there are two things, particularly in our midrash, that relate to the feminine experience, and that is divorce and first relations with her husband. Now, this connects back to the curse on woman. What does it say there? El ha'isha amar harbe arbe etzvonech, ve'aronech be'etzev tildi, unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your pain and your travail and pain. You shall bring forth children, and your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Now, this is descriptive, not prescriptive. Those who want to use epidurals will use epidurals. Those who choose to be dominated in their relationships with their husband, not necessarily. Here it's descriptive, not prescriptive. And I think it's important. But it says here there's something essential about what happens to woman ever after as a result of the sin of Eve's folly there in the garden. She will ever after suffer the pangs in childbirth, and there will be a vulnerability with her husband that women, I think, uniquely feel. What about the idea of birth? The birth, what's interesting about the birth experience is that the Vlad, here it seems to me the Midrash is focusing on the experience of the Vlad, of the newborn, and not necessarily on the mother. Right? It's not about the pangs of the mother at birth. It's when the child emerges from the womb. So there's an anomaly there that doesn't totally fit the pattern. But death, right, when the soul leaves the body, that's surely a necessary consequence of the sin of the Garden of Eden, because it says, El afar, one of the consequences of the sin is, El afar tashuv. For you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Mortality is a necessary consequence of the sin of the Garden of Eden. So, in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, when they go back, let's go back one step back and look at the consequences for women. In Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, I was in Georgian Bay. There was a phenomenal lightning storm on Saturday night. Really, so that was nothing. I hope your camera's okay. Okay. So for the woman, Natan Leisha Miteisha Klalot, the Mavet, what were the 10 curses that woman is to experience? One of them is Inui Leita V'Inui Dam Tulim, the pain of the first coitus and the pain of giving birth. So that relates back to the two of the six phenomena. Death we talked about. Now I want to switch gears a little. And so all of the six phenomena hark back to the Garden of Eden experience. And there, you asked the question about a voice. What do they have to do with a voice? What I'd like to suggest is that the voice is a voice of yearning. A yearning for a consummation that can never be fulfilled. The voice cannot be heard because there really is no return to the Garden of Eden in the way that we know it. Right? We can never return to the pristine state. There are portals through which we can go in order to return to that Garden of Eden experience, but it's inaccessible as is described in Bereshit. So the voice that travels from one end of the earth to the other is a voice of yearning. It says, I wish that the soul and body could stay united. I wish that man and woman could merge and stay as one and not have that tension. I wish birth didn't involve the kind of pain and agony that it involved. All of these are desires. The snake even expresses a desire that it shouldn't suffer the curse of the primordial snake and have to slough off its skin every 7 years with dire pain. The fruit tree wishes that that original voice had been heard. But the voice that travels from one end of the earth to the other is really a voice of yearning, and it's not heard because it cannot be fulfilled. So what is our source of amelioration? Where do we get tikkun? We're always looking for tikkun in our lives. So where do we get tikkun? And with this, I'd like to take you on two different paths. I just want to gauge people's energy level. How are you? Are you with me? I could conclude with a Hasidic story. I could take you on another tangent. The tangent is really the tangent of what the fate of the snake skin, and I want to know if you're up for going there with me or not. Yeah? You want to go? Okay. It's a little bit of a journey. It's a wild journey. So stretch. So let's stretch a little bit. Go a little bit there. Okay. So the fate of the snake skin, and I think this points to an interesting hint of a tikkun. So what happens to the original snakeskin? The first act of sloughing off, the first molting that happens? Apparently, when God wove together the garments of skin, where did he take those garments of skin from them? From? He took it from the original serpent. Very interesting. Now one could say that the problem is, in Hebrew it says, Vayas Hashem Elokim le'Adam u'lishto kotnot or v'lyalbishem. God made for Adam and Eve, for his wife, garments of skins, and he clothed them. Now, where did he take the skins from? After all, no animal had yet been slaughtered. So where did he get these skins from? Must have come from the snake. Right? The snake that was cursed and forced to become dismembered and in its skin. So he wove together the snake skin and made garments for Adam and Eve. Very strange. Strange image. I think it's highly ironic that God would take the skin of the beast to clothe them in order to cover their nakedness, which they had only become aware of as a result of the skin. As a result of the sin, they became aware of their nakedness, and he takes the skin from the very beast that had created the calamity, that had seduced Eve, right? Very strange that he dresses them in this skin. Very ironic. So where is this coming from? You could say that the skin is a necessary consequence of the eating of the fruit. They were naked. They became aware of their nakedness. They have to be dressed in something. The skin is the only thing that's available. Too simple, right? Too simple. No, it's much more complex than that. I'd like to suggest that, and I think in the context where the act of dressing happens, God is giving them a means of protecting themselves against the snake. In the context of the Midrash, he dresses them when Adam says, oh, I'm going into a state of banishment. I'm going into the wide world. What am I going to do? The snake will strike me in the heel and I'll be killed. I'll die. So God gives him protection. He gives him two gifts. He gives him the gift of the clothing, the snake skin, and he gives him the gift of fire. Two gifts as he goes into banishment. Now, let's look at that. Apparently, this is one of the 10 items that is created, Benashmashot, Nivru Benashmashot, according to the Talmud, according to other sources. It's one of the 10 items that's created, Benashmashot. So God is saying, here, I'm giving you this clothing because I want you to take a little bit of the garden with you. I want you to take that Garden of Eden experience, that prelapsarian feel. I want you to take that with you. I want you to take the aura of the garden with you. And he does. But what happens to the garments?
is they end up in the wrong hands.
Let's look at the Midrash. Number 14 on your page. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Hakutnot Shasa Akadosh Baruch Hu Le'Adam U'Lishto Hayu Im Noach U'Banav El Hativa. Kshe'yatsu Min Hativa Cham Ben Noach Hotzi'uha Imo V'Hinchila L'Nimrod.
The garments ended up going with Noach on the ark.
Noach then bequeathed it to Shem, to Cham, not Shem, to Cham ben Noach, and he then bequeathed it to Nimrod, who is described in Genesis as the Nimrod who hachel liot gibor ba'aretz. He was a great and mighty hunter in the world. So the Midrash says, how did he become a great and mighty hunter in the world? Through the snake skin. The snake was the original hunter. He was the original predator. He was a predator through language, through the distortion of the words of God. And through his distortion of the words, he seduced Eve. So too here, Nimrod dons the original garments of the serpent, and he is filled with a kind of a will to power. He becomes an ubermensch. And all of the beasts of the earth see him, and they bow down to him, thinking he's the creator. And then the other human beings look at Nimrod, and they say, look at how the animals are reacting. We shall make him king. And he becomes the first emperor who rules misof haolam ve'ad sofo. He rules from one end of the earth to the other. Obviously, everybody hears him. Okay? So he's the first one. Now, what happened to the clothing then? Esav, the brother of Jacob, the Midrash continues, number 17 on your page, the next page. Esav saw them on Nimrod, coveted them, desired them, and murdered, took a hold of the cloaks. Now, how do we know he did such a thing? Because the cloaks, the garments of Esav, are described as hachamudot, the coveted ones. The word chamad, lachmod, al tachmod, one of the Ten Commandments, not to covet. Well, what did those garments do? They inspired covetousness. Right, inspired is not the right word, but let's say they stimulated desire for those cloaks. So here, the serpent once wore them, and he was desirous of Eve. He wanted Eve. Nimrod wore them. What did he want? He wanted power. Esav saw the power that these cloaks bestowed on Nimrod, then committed murder. And killed Nimrod, took a hold of these cloaks, and then who got a hold of the cloaks?
Jacob.
Yaakov is the first one to realize their power and decide, not for me. This is dangerous. And we have to assume that he was wearing the snakeskin cloak when he went in before his father. And he stood before his father and he said, Anochi Bini Bechorecha, Anochi Bechorecha Esav. I am your firstborn Esav. He lied. I'm not going to make any apologies. Rashi says, reads it differently. He says, Anochi Bechorecha Esav, right? I am who I am. But your firstborn is Esav. I'm not going to make any apologies for Jacob. I'm going to say that he assumed snake-like behavior, serpent-like behavior, when he stood before his father and he deceived him and pretended he was Esav. He was enacting the same role that the serpent enacted when he distorted the first words of God, the first command of God. You shan't die. You know, you won't die. Lo motamutam. Right? That's what he said. So too, Yaakov takes on these cloaks. He realizes their power. He realizes their reptilian characteristics, and he says, not for me. What does he decide to do? He decides to bury them in the ground, and then he quotes, beautiful quote from Job, the rope lies hidden for him in the ground. It lies hidden because this is a noose by which man could hang himself. So, I'd like to say, let's go back to the gift.
why does God do this? Why does God give the snake skin to Adam and Eve? Is this a source of amelioration? Is it a way of softening the consequences of the banishment? Is that what he's really doing? If they contain the possibility of snake-like behavior, of deception, the will to power, all of these things, why would God give them to this, give them to man? I'd like to say, it's not about amelioration. It's a natural consequence for how the cloaks can be used once they move into the state, the post-lapsarian state, after Gan Eden, after they move into exile. When they don the cloaks, then it takes on the power. They take on a power, a dangerous power. And this is just the result, the natural consequence of our post-lapsarian state, of being outside of the garden and being in a state of exile. So that could have been a source of tikkun. That could have been a source of amelioration, but human nature is what it is. And when it dons a snake's cloak, it becomes snake-like. So what is another source of amelioration? Another source of amelioration, and here I want to go back to this motif of the voice. The voice which is not heard. And this is something that, Jay, I think you hinted at in your little introduction about your mother. The voice of the Torah is another way of getting back to the Garden of Eden. And what happened at Sinai? What happened at Sinai? There was a voice at Sinai. And the voice that was experienced at Sinai is also experienced with a kind of synesthesia. Let's look at that psuk. It's number 19 on your source. V'chol ha'am ro'im et ha'kolot ve'et ha'lapidim ve'et kol ha'shofar ve'et ha'har ha'shan v'yar ha'am v'yanu'u v'yamdu mirchok. And all the people saw the voices, that is, or thunder, depending on how you want to read that, and the lightning and the sound of the shofar and the mountain smoking, and when the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. So they saw the voices. What does it mean, ro'im et kolot? And here I'd like to tell you a little Hasidic story that I found in Buber's collection, Tales of the Hasidim, in Volume 2. This is a story about the son of Rabbi Yitzchak, who's known as Haro'eh, the seer, who died around 1868. And his son is Rabbi Menachem Mendel. At the Shiva, they're all sitting Shiva for Rabbi Yitzchak, and they're the famous rabbi that comes to the Shiva. And he had been a disciple of Rabbi Yitzchak, but had fallen away and began to follow one of his students, I think. He was a prodigal student, let's say. And yet still remained quite close to the family. And he calls the two sons of Rabbi Yitzchak, and he says, you know, I've always been disturbed by the expression ro'im et kolot. Can you explain seeing of the voices, that Har Sinai? What was that experience of seeing the voices? And one of the sons, Rabbi Yaakov David, gives a very erudite answer and says this, and it's really thunder. And, Rabbi Binyamin says, okay, fine. That's interesting. And then he turns to Rabbi Menachem Mendel, who's renowned for his silence. He's very, very quiet, always silent. And he says to him, what do you think of this expression, ro'im et kolot? And he said, thought for a very, very long time. And he said, what we have to do when we learn Torah is we have to re-experience that original experience at Sinai, that experience of synesthesia, ro'im et kolot. He said, what you have to do is you have to take the voice inside yourselves and internalize it. You have to make it your own. So that it becomes a total experience. It's not just about hearing. It's about seeing, it's about feeling, it's about thinking. It's a total experience. That's what synesthesia is about. Synesthesia is saying, I'm experiencing through an unconventional source, sense source, what one would normally only hear.
So the tikkun,
the amelioration, right, the source of tikkun for the voice that wasn't heard, that yearning for Gan Eden, that yearning for the garden, is through the internalization of Torah, through the learning of Torah, bringing the interface between the other world, the world that's beyond sense, the sixth sense, and bringing it closer to one's life.